Well, thank you. This is actually the first time I've had an opportunity to attend this meeting. I'm finding it very interesting, and it actually makes you want to come back because I find people here are talking about a lot of the same things I'm interested in, but you know, maybe from just a little bit different perspective. I did want to spend just a little bit of time talking about what Desert Research Institute is, or we're actually in a we're trying to do a rebranding right now. Just call ourselves DRI because we actually do work all over the world now, including large programs in Antarctica and Greenland. But we are a little bit unusual, a nonprofit environmental research campus of the Nevada System of Higher Education. I'm a faculty member, but we don't have tenure. We raise our salaries through grants and contracts. We do have graduate students, but they actually earn their degree at another school. So they primarily come to work with us on their on the research part of their graduate degrees. We have three divisions, but I'm sure is not a surprise to anyone, you know, increasingly our research, and I'm sure yours, is more and more interdisciplinary in nature, and so that's some of the direction we're heading right now. DRI was formed in 1959. I don't often think of Nevada being a very progressive state, but I think it was somewhat, probably unusual on the part of Nevada to form an organization like that within the state education system at the time. What are some of the types of research that we're doing or trying to do more of? We certainly are interested in impacts of climate change on both hydrologic, physical, biological, but increasingly the human systems as well. And part of that, of course, is human health. Modeling and visualization, and I want to mention here, particularly after the first presentation, that part of our reason for focusing on visualization is that we're just, our society is simply becoming more visual. And I think in terms of the need to commute with broader audiences, effective visualization tools are effective ways of bringing different groups of people together. What I want to focus on with the rest of the talk mostly is what I would call our increasing focus on looking at systems, and including implications for public health. We certainly are doing research that has direct public health implications. We have a program for clean water development in West Africa, for example. We have a strong program in looking at aerosols and their impacts on respiratory disease. In our hydrologic sciences, we're looking at some of the emerging contaminants in groundwater and surface water, like pharmaceuticals and things like that. But more broadly speaking, the changes that are going on in the natural environment, whether they're just natural variations or as a result of climate change, on top of, particularly in areas like the Western United States where population is growing, are creating situations that if they're not public health problems now, could become public health issues that What I'm hoping is that the type of research we're doing will help to maybe forecast where there are public health needs in the future, and so that we aren't reacting to them so much, but we're starting to anticipate them. So I'll start with an example on one scale, and that's work we're doing. I borrowed this term from somebody, landscape epidemiology, although I think I've seen it at the conference here. So I feel better that I didn't just make this up. But this is work by Dr. Ken McGuire, who's been using GIS tools to look at disease vectors, in this case the hantavirus. And probably the simpler model for hantavirus from year to year in the Southwest was that the frequency of it depended on the availability of food for like the deer mice that carried it. But the aspect that we've been increasingly trying to add is the landscape component. What Ken and others who are working in this area are finding is that you might find a high prevalence of hantavirus from year to year in a particular area, but if that plant community or something was not connected, was an isolated one, in terms of a human health risk, it might remain fairly isolated, and might even die out from year to year, So what Ken and others have done has tried to look at the connectiveness between habitats to see, where are the areas where something like hantavirus from year to year would have the most opportunity to spread, and to make sure that our sampling strategies for it were capturing those connected environments. So these are another number of elements that make a difference in terms of hantavirus. The sagebrush environment is probably where it's most common. It might seem a little funny to put a GIS image of a density of roads in the area, but what we found was that there was not always a great effort to sample all the environments where it might occur. And as we were able to develop better sampling strategies and look at this degree of connectedness, we had a better ability then to predict it from year to year. And this is maybe a common sort of population dynamic where it's most common in the July to September period. But the other aspect of this that I might just add is that now we're also trying to add that sort of urban wildland interface. Where are we growing into areas where a disease vector occurs and increases the risk for people as receptors to come in contact with it. A second example is work we're doing in China, and I almost feel like when we're talking about like the rate of growth of Denver over the next 40 years, I've been working on a project. This is in the Shanghai region, and it's almost like the world just being speeded up. For some of you working in developing parts of the country, I'm sure you've experienced this. Our focus originally and still is on Lake Tahoe, which is the third largest lake in China, and has a long history. It's part of the Grand Canal that many Chinese view as one of their great public works achievements, built over 1,000 years ago to help bring food and water to areas like Beijing during periods of drought. But as the Shanghai area has grown in population to over 45 million, and the area has rapidly industrialized, Lake Tahoe has gone from what was once a kind of point of beauty to this being its more, now what it's probably more famous for are these very severe eutrophication events, often involving cyanobacteria. Some of you may have remembered during the, just prior to the Olympics in China, I think it was the sailing was done just off the coast of Shanghai, and all the work that was done to take care of an algal bloom just in the weeks prior to that. That's kind of in this same region of China. And there is, you know, probably a temptation to kind of like, when you look at this, to sort of throw up your hands and say, well, you know, where do we even start? And but working with our Chinese colleagues, you know, we've started to sort of break it down. It's not as if the whole lake typically has these blooms. Tends to be more in some of the bays. And there's like three tributaries that contribute something like 80% of the total loading of things like phosphorus and nitrogen. So, you know, if you're going to target areas, you know, there is that information that's available. A problem that we see increasing, and this is really not just in China, it's also occurring in the U.S., but I imagine it'll occur faster in China as more and more people have cars, is that 30% or more of the loading of pollutants into Tahoe Lake now is airborne deposition, and that really hasn't been appreciated very much. In the case of Tahoe Lake, you know, the sort of quick reaction might be, well, we'll just use another water source, and that's what they're doing with, which is groundwater. But if you've been in that part of China, you know it's at a very low elevation. They're already experiencing saltwater incursion into their water supply. So simply moving from one water source to another is not going to be the answer. I'll try to finish up quickly here with kind of a broader view of climate change. Some of the climate change projections in the next 50 years. And I think some of these, I think a lot of people would agree, are already occurring. Those of you here in Colorado know that we've been seeing decreased snowfalls in the mountains, and those snowpacks melting quicker. Wildfires are becoming more common in all environments in the West, you know, including desert environments where they never historically occurred. Oddly enough, when it does rain, they tend to be, this is a nationwide trend, tend to be more intense storms. And although the projections vary, 1 to 2.5 degrees Celsius increase in temperature by the end of the century. Well, what are some of the implications then, as in terms of a system, and you know, where does it start intersecting public health? Well, with that, our whole network really for like water conveyance in the West, like in the Colorado system, is really dependent on the snowfall, say here in Colorado or New Mexico, providing base flow year-round for places like Lake Mead and Lake Powell that serve, you know, whether it's irrigation or municipal water. And we really need to look at whether our infrastructure needs to change, or whether at least the way we manage that infrastructure. So it's not just the environmental change, it's also the built environment. We built it for a certain pattern of the environment, and if that's changing, we now need to look at different infrastructures or managing it differently. Other feedbacks is with fire is we're seeing it as a much greater component of emissions now. And another element maybe for a respiratory illnesses that people have overlooked is that fewer precipitation events in cities like Phoenix, where people brought in a lot of exotic plants, those periodic rainfalls do cut down a lot on pollen counts, and an increasing area of concern is that EPA is beginning to try to address is ground-based ozone. That's something else that, while rainfall doesn't fix it, it tends to at least prevent its buildup. So that, of course, has significant public health implications as well. So I kind of ending with this because none of them individually are necessarily a public health concern, but collectively looking at a system, they are. And we've been talking about the urban environment. I think all of us know that that now over half the world's population lives in urban areas. I think there were projections for, you know, when we were going to meet it, we easily beat that, particularly with some countries like China. But here in the Western United States, whether it's Denver, Phoenix, Las Vegas, I mean, we're seeing a lot of urban growth in the Intermountain West. I haven't talked a lot about one of the themes of this conference, environmental justice and things like that. But a concern, I guess, of mine is that I'm concerned the risk of the welfare of urban environments is going to come at the expense of broader environment and people that are still living in urban areas. That, you know, the simple solution, whether it's for Las Vegas or for Shanghai, is we'll simply just go out into the countryside, and that's where we'll get our water, and of course that's affecting the welfare of the people there, and I also think it is detrimental in the long term in terms of our understanding of as we become more and more urbanized and people get maybe less and less connected to their environment, of understanding what the impacts of their lifestyle are on the, you know, on the broader environment. So I'll end with that, and thank you.